Hey, everybody, and welcome to a bonus episode of Beyond the Breakers. My name is Tanner. I'm here, as always, with Taylor. Taylor, how's it going?
Pretty good. It's still cold and snowy in Ohio. I'm sure it's still pretty chilly up there in Wisconsin, too, though, huh?
It is. I see a little bit of melting happening outside, though.
Nice.
We are here to put to rest our most epic series to date. We finished up the main sequence of Lusitania. We published that on Christmas Eve. And so here, as we mentioned in the main series, we've got a few things to wrap up as a special VIP super secret bonus episode. This doesn't really follow linearly from the end of the main story, but a couple of things to fill in that just didn't fit anywhere else. Mm-hmm. And even this is not all the stuff that we wanted to talk about. But we've got to end it somewhere. The first thing that I really want to discuss here is the British blockade. And it's interesting because it kind of is a background character in the story of the Lusitania.
Right.
The unrestricted submarine warfare gets the headlines because that's the most visible thing that's happening, seeing ships torpedoed and people dying. And for the Germans, the rationale for the unrestricted warfare was the British blockade. Mm-hmm. To discuss this, I'm going to be referring to an article from the University of Toronto Law Journal called Slow or Spectacular Death, Reconsidering the Legal History of Blockade and Submarines in World War I.
Yeah, it is an interesting time, too, because for the first time, you're really seeing an effective way to break a blockade, potentially. And if you look back to like the American Civil War, part of what makes the Union so successful is the ability to completely cut off the Confederacy from trading. So it's very interesting that blockades are a very effective tool, but you finally have a reasonably cheap way of defeating that.
We finally see this. It's one of those times in history where you see, quote unquote, legal warfare come head to head with new technologies that have not been considered yet.
You're seeing some of that now with like drone warfare and stuff mm-hmm. in the modern battlefield. But like when the technology is ahead of the law or doctrine in war, you get some interesting and often bad things happening.
Whole story of World War One is, you know, mm-hmm. technology outpacing doctrine. So this article presents international law not as a set of restrictions that trump other concerns, but just as another tool at a nation's disposal in addition to military strategy, politics, and diplomacy. Just kind of all tools in the bag here. Mm-hmm. An idea that would sound reminiscent to Karl von Clausewitz and his idea that war is just an extension of diplomacy, you know, by other means.
Accounts of the justness and legality of civilian targeting are generally framed within the spectacular, the attack by carpet bombing, drones, or cluster munitions, for example. But slow death, through embargo or blockade, is also part of the story of civilian targeting and has only been intermittently explored in the historical or legal historical literature. It is especially curious that the maritime blockade of Germany by Britain, the most significant and famous blockade of the last 100 years, has received little attention from legal historians.
So there was an established history of using blockade as a tool of war, but no nation had ever really had the power to enforce one quite like Britain did at this point in history. No one had ever had a navy that was this much more powerful than the people that they were fighting than Britain would have. And so they were kind of in a unique position of actually being able to do this through the 19th into the early 20th century. Obviously, British sea power wasn't a new thing. They had, with great effectiveness, you know, choked off the colonies during the Revolution and the United States during the War of 1812, basically shutting down the Eastern Seaboard. So that wasn't new.
Right.
It was the Crimean War that actually caused a deeper discussion on the legality of the tactic. So after the Crimean War, ultimately Britain would agree to the 1856 Declaration of Paris. And this declaration included a few other decrees that put forth these not necessarily laws, but just kind of agreed regulations that would sound familiar to someone who has read about naval war in World War I. The first of those is the abolition of privateering. Privateer is something you hear about in the early 1800s, but mm-hmm. not so much in the late part. And after that, privateer is not really a thing anymore.
It is interesting that like privateers are almost like the private military contractors of their day.
Essentially, yes. I mean, that's what you've got here. Another one is that a neutral flag covered all enemy goods except contraband of war. So if even if it belonged to a belligerent state, if it was traveling on a neutral craft and it wasn't war contraband, you couldn't mm-hmm. touch it, basically. Neutral goods, except contraband for war, were no longer liable to capture under an enemy flag. So again, you can't use the excuse that it's on an enemy vessel to take it.
Okay.
And finally, the most interesting and the most legally significant is that blockades had to consist of a force strong enough to prevent access to the ports or coast of an enemy in order to be, quote, legal. Which kind of sounds like a weird rule, like you have to be able to blockade to be able to blockade. The idea being you can't just declare a blockade and then get mad when people violate it if you don't have the ships to enforce it.
Right, you can't put like one little warship out there and be like, "Oh, I'm blockading this."
It's like a ghost runner on second when you're playing kickball. You can't do that with a blockade. You can't say, "Well, I'm technically blockading all of this." You can't come in here if you don't have the ships to actually physically enforce it.
Right. So, like, really though, these, like you said, these aren't like any kind of binding legal things, right? This is more like best practices almost.
Exactly. And even with some of these, you'll see, I forget if it was the Declaration of Paris or if it was one of the later ones, the London Declaration. You'll see where they kind of do attempt to codify them in law. And sometimes they'll say pass in the House of Commons and then, you know, they might die in the House of Lords. So they're never totally codified. But the whole nature of these declarations is that they're gleaned from what people are agreeing to anyway. What have we kind of come to say, this is the rule that we're going to follow?
Right.
So despite the fact that these seemed like restrictions on the British, they actually ended up protecting her as she was more often the neutral party as the 19th century came into the 20th century. You know, she's not fighting as many wars as she used to. Mm-hmm. In most cases, she is the neutral party that needs to be protected. And a good example of this is the Russo-Japanese War. In many ways, that war sort of upset a lot of precedents. You had, you know, Japan, an Asian power defeating a European one. And this was a great example of this. Britain protested when the Russians declared all Japanese material on neutral ships as contraband.
Britain held fast to the position that food for civilians could not be considered contraband and therefore could not be subject to blockade.
That's funny. Isn't it?
It really is.
Britain is so concerned about what can and cannot be blockaded. It's kind of the story of Russia's history, kind of trying to play at the table with Europe and very often kind of being shunted aside. And well, it's like, well, we can do this, but you can't do this. You're not allowed to break all the rules that we can break.
And we're still dealing with the consequences today.
So to see where the legality of blockade was at the outbreak of World War I, we can look at the London Declaration of 1909. So some of the things that came out there is that confirmed that blockade was a legitimate method of warfare if carried out properly. Blockade of neutral ports was prohibited.
Okay.
Fair. And the three categories that get discussed very often when you talk about World War I and submarine warfare, these were categories of contraband. So at the top, we've got absolute contraband. Mm-hmm. As the name indicates, this is weapons, ammunition, uniforms, anything with a pure, direct or
military application,
or maybe only military purpose, something that has no conceivable civilian use. Civilians don't need high explosive artillery shells, for example. The other is conditional contraband. So this is things that could conceivably have a direct application in civilian or military use. So fuel for vehicles themselves, food, animal feed, anything that could potentially be used for either one. And the final category is called the free list. This is a lot of raw materials that would need to be processed to be used. So raw cotton is an example. Manure is another one. And then also household and luxury goods, things that you can't conceivably think of as having a military application.
Right. They're more general use. Or you said things that would have to be refined further to make them usable.
So that's kind of the when they talk about something being declared contraband, that's usually why they determine that, you know, this is conditional contraband, but it's headed for this port or it's headed for this area. We think it's going to go to, you know, this military sector, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
One item that had been almost entirely overlooked in any discussion of naval warfare was the submarine. Which, after the fact, seems ridiculous that this was never discussed before the war started.
I was actually thinking about that. Like, when we have that list of, like, what constitutes, like, a legitimate blockade, at the time, submarines are, like, these this new thing. Like, that's probably not considered something that would be a legitimate blockade, I wouldn't imagine. Like, they're not thinking of submarines as a legitimate tool.
To the extent they're even being thought of as separate from surface vessels. Because their potential is totally not understood, because they haven't really been applied in wartime yet. In part one, we talked a lot about the submarine being ignored and overlooked by most navies as a truly useful technology, certainly by the elite navies. You know, Britain, Prussia, or Germany weren't really paying that much attention to these. They were seen, kind of predicted as being useful maybe in harbor defense and coastal patrols. So really, they weren't thought of that much, and they were subjected to the same rules as any other warship.
Yeah, and when, like, their overall operation, it doesn't work that way. Like, you can't have the same rules of warfare for a destroyer and an airplane, right?
This is what lays the groundwork for that conflict with the cruiser rules that the U-boat captains end up complaining so fiercely and kind of legitimately about. You know, because of their size, they have, you know, small crews relative to a surface vessel. They can't do all the same things. They can't follow those cruiser rules. They're not able to follow along with these things. You know, they can't. There's not enough people to put a prize crew on a captured vessel. There's not enough room on their ship to take on passengers or people who've escaped from a sinking ship. It simply doesn't work the same way for a submarine. So really, from a strict legal sense, the unrestricted submarine warfare wasn't illegal because it was submarines. It was because they were any sort of sailing vessel doing these things. There was nothing unique about the submarine in the eye of this law or this rule. So we talked about enforcing a legal blockade. And a key component was that all enemy ports had to be blockaded. You know, you made reference to the Union blockade of the Confederacy in the Civil War. And yeah, you've got all those major ports being blockaded, you know, most famously places like Charleston. But that's kind of the rule of the blockade, is you've got to be able to cover every single port or else it's not legal.
That's interesting. That's something I was not aware of. So that is, it's really, really interesting, actually. So, like, at this time, how would you have even blockaded a country like the United States, where you've got ports from New Orleans all the way up to Maine?
Right. You know, another reason that the U.S. is kind of in this unique position where, not just from a physical distance, but for many other reasons, somewhat invulnerable to some of the same tactics that would have worked on a country with, you know, relatively little seacoast like Germany. Here we get into, just based on the geography of these things that we talked a lot about in the Scapa Flow episode, Britain could totally lock down the North Sea. You know, they could make sure the German fleet never left. They could blockade all those German seaports on the North Sea. But the problem was the Baltic. They could have, in theory, gotten ships into the Baltic, but they would have been dangerously exposed. And it was just not a risk that they wanted to run. You know, we spent all that time talking about Britain not wanting a big showdown with the German Navy, and that would have been a great way to make that happen.
Right.
So they can't touch those Baltic seaports, inherently making their blockade unenforceable and therefore illegal.
Interesting.
Because Germany still had those ports open. So, what to do if you are a enterprising world power? You can not officially declare a blockade, for starters. That is one way to get through that legal loophole of just saying, hey, this is not a blockade. Who's blockading? No one's blockading anyone here.
I feel like that's also the difference between what a POW and a what enemy combatant.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, just decide that this isn't what this is. So also quoting here from that article, an order in council of 29 October allowed the foreign secretary to declare a neutral port a, quote, base of supplies for the enemy, which rendered any contraband heading for Rotterdam now subject to seizure by the British Navy. There was no precedent in international law for this move.
I'm glad to see the old someone tell me to stop, like, thing is around at this point, too. It's like, well, I'm just going to do it, and someone tell me no.
Jim Carrey in The Mask diplomacy is what this is called. somebody stop me. So yeah, you have this idea of, it's like, well, okay, they're getting goods into these neutral ports. What if we just declare the neutral port not neutral? We say this is an enemy base of supplies because they're supplying the enemy. Ipso facto, it's an enemy port. We're going to blockade it. And, you know, this is Rotterdam. This is the Netherlands, who's not taking part in the war at all. They're a fully neutral port.
Right. Yeah. Like, wouldn't that require, like, you to declare war on them at that point, technically?
One would think. Again, because it's all this legal wrangling of, you know, they decided, you know, back in the 1850s, you can't blockade a neutral port. It's like, mm-hmm. Well, what if I say it's an enemy port first? There we go. So around this time, there's more legal complications. There's lots of back and forth. And that's why this grabbed me so much, because I'd never read about this and I didn't realize how deep it went. So at the start of the war, Germany had laid unanchored floating mines in the North Sea to try and mitigate some of, you know, that British superiority at sea.
That sounds bad.
And that is illegal under the 1907 Hague Convention number 8, which at least at the time of writing here was the only formal restriction on mines in the ocean. But yeah, so the issue was with them being unanchored, you know, not chained or tethered anywhere. They're just floating free. You kind of see the issues with that when you see ships like we talked about, the Britannic.
Yeah.
Most likely striking a mine that, you know, if it's floating free, you have no idea what it's going to hit.
Right.
These indiscriminate mines were illegal under that convention. And so actually, this is the rationale for Britain declaring the whole of the North Sea a war zone, which they do on November 5th, 1914. And what this does, sneaky, sneaky snakes, is it allows them to basically make a functional distant blockade rather than that strictly legal close blockade.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have to get into the Baltic Sea and blockade those ports if we can just declare this whole area a war zone and stop everything that's coming through it. And they can do that because, hey, the Germans are clearly deciding this is a war zone if they're using these mines. So we will just play along and agree that it's a war zone.
That is interesting. They're both using like each other to justify the escalation. You're seeing that like escalation loop kind of happen.
Yeah, you see this. It's just reprisal after reprisal to the extent that it's very hard to see, okay, who actually did break the rule first.
Right. It almost becomes irrelevant, right? Like at a certain point.
So yeah, interestingly, it's that sort of unilateral declaration by Britain saying that the North Sea is an official war zone. This is the exact precedent that the Germans use later to do the same thing to the waters around Britain, saying, hey, you said that this was that our coastal waters are a war zone. We're just going to do the same thing to you. And that is the rationale for why the submarine campaign is legal thing. We said it's a war zone. If you're in the war zone, we can sink you.
Yeah, it's interesting because we don't talk about that part very much, I think, from like the American perspective, because it's, mm-hmm. you know, we obviously go in on the side of the Allies, and that's the story that we end up kind of telling. But it is interesting to see that, like, the Germans aren't irrationally doing this. Like, there's a method to what they're doing and a reason for it.
And in fact, you know, we tried so hard to stay neutral. We spend basically 3 years complaining to Britain about what they're doing and saying this isn't legal. You can't do this. You're violating neutral rights. And nothing really comes of it.
Mm-hmm.
So unrestricted submarine warfare began in early 1915. Quoting here, like the British, the Germans' greatest fear in following necessity into illegal acts against neutrals was American retaliation. In light of the ineffective American protests in December to the British blockade, the Germans were not irrational in their belief that the Americans would allow them to break the law as well. So after the outcry over the Lusitania that we've spent 4 episodes talking about, plus, of course, other vessels, on August 28th, German Chancellor Bethmann Hollweg, he informed the Navy to resume observation of cruiser rules, saying basically, fun's over, you've got to go back to playing by the rules. And I mean, essentially, the high seas fleet basically takes their ball and goes home.
Right.
They've realized this is an effective tool. It's obviously shaking the Allies, and now you're telling us we can't do it anymore. So basically, what is a submarine good for if we can't use it?
To kind of inflict the maximum amount of damage to the enemy, right?
Exactly. So all these submarine captains are recalled to their home ports, and they don't really get up to much because, like we said, this is the best thing they're good for. That ends the first bit of unrestricted submarine warfare. So Germany continues to file protests against the actions of the British blockade, some of which are patently illegal and really only gotten around by some clever legal wrangling. Mm-hmm. Sometimes not even that, sometimes just straight up ignoring the rules. So with no change or weakening of Britain's blockade, there's the ultimate resumption of unrestricted submarine warfare in 1917. And we know that would bring the US into the war. And yeah, really the strategy behind that was, hey, if we can do this again and we can knock Britain out before the Americans get here, it'll be worth it. Obviously, that doesn't end up happening. US enters the war with some help from the Zimmermann Telegram, which we talked about was connected to the submarine warfare, saying mm-hmm. this is a safety blanket in case we do this and the US comes in the war, Mexico, help a buddy out.
Right. I think that probably shows you how desperate Germany is at that point, too. That's not something that they're sending in 1914 to Mexico, mm-hmm. I don't think, to be like, hey, you want to attack the US? Because yeah. I mean, you'd have to know at that point when you bring in the United States, like it's not a beatable number of people that are coming. You know what I mean? Like, this, the amount of material and men that they're able to bring to bear, you've lost at that point.
So in part, I think it was in part four, we talked about U.S. Secretary of State William Jennings Bryan and his legal concerns over Britain's blockade. He was the one who wanted to send a protest to Britain rather than Germany after the Lusitania was sunk. On May 9th, 1915, so this is 2 days after the Lusitania, he wrote to Wilson saying, Germany has a right to prevent contraband going to the Allies, and a ship carrying contraband should not rely on passengers to protect her from attack. It would be like putting women and children in front of an army.
That's like the ultimate in, like, you're right, but is this the time to say it?
Is this really the time, William? And like he makes that comparison, and you see that comparison sometimes to justify Germany's actions. You know, it's like putting children on the battlefield. I think under some examination, it's not a perfect parallel because here we have a submarine going to basically a civilian area of the belligerent country and sinking a passenger vessel. That's more akin to an army marching through a city and killing people.
I continue to be like, I keep thinking about the comparisons between the submarine stuff and the drone stuff. And how often did we hear stories of, well, we got a top Al-Qaeda operative, but he was at a wedding, so a bunch of women and children got killed. And it's sort of the same thing in a way, if you think about it, that, you know, you don't have to fire that missile in, you know what I mean? Or you don't have to fire that torpedo into the ocean liner. Like, yeah, is it technically a military target? I guess if you want to conceive of it that way, but you don't have to do it.
No, you shouldn't be secretly transporting stuff or not secretly transporting stuff on a passenger vessel. That's, you know, basically using them as a human shield if you're assuming this ship won't be sunk for that reason.
I sort of think of it as like, you'll see it a lot in like stupid, like, retail videos, like where someone's like freaking out over something. It's like always like, is it worth it? As like a retail employee, sometimes would you bend the rules for someone if like you just wanted them to go away, even if they were wrong? You know what I mean? It's like, it's just not worth it to do this. And I sort of feel that way with sinking this, like an ocean liner, right? Like, could you technically be correct? Yes. But like, is it worth being correct like that? Probably not.
And as you pointed out, like, U-boat captains had different personalities. Probably some of them would have decided not to sink the Lusitania, saying this is a passenger vessel. I don't want this on my conscience. And, you know, some of them, as we saw with Walter Schwieger, would say, this is a legitimate target. I'm going to sink it.
There was probably some, too, that probably would have been, hey, I don't like it, but I'm going to do it because I don't want someone to question me. You know, there's all sorts of different shades and places you can take that.
So that idea that we just talked about from Brian, this was also echoed by some legal experts in Britain, although maybe somewhat wisely, they would wait to talk about this until after the war ended. It's not always what you say, but also when you say it. Quoting here from a piece called Discussion on the Abolition of Submarines. The torpedoing of unarmed ships in the war was wrong, but no seaman would consider the torpedoing of armed ships to be unfair. For an armed ship, is a fighting ship. If she's not a fighting ship, why is she armed?
Right.
The guns are not carried merely for the purpose of ornament. But we armed the majority of our merchant ships in the war, and it's impossible for the Germans to distinguish from an unarmed merchant ship. In the case of our Q ships, the armament was purposely concealed and the disguise was perfect.
That's such an interesting concept of, well, you're going to sink my merchant ships, so I have to arm them. And then the Germans are, you know, well, we have to sink all of your ships because we don't know which ones are armed.
It's kind of a very cynical piece of writing there, because it's like, well, yeah, of course we disguised our ships to look like passenger ships.
Right.
What, are we stupid?
Right.
Yeah. It's kind of one of those, like, and he just tweeted it out things. Of course, that was the goal, was to cause confusion. And we did it very well. So the interwar years led to a new and I think a little bit more honest discussion of the legality of the blockade. Mm-hmm. So one issue raised was the British practice of taking ships into port for inspection, basically giving them time to work up a case against,
right,
why is this contraband? What rationale do we have for this? Rather than the more expected practice of inspecting them at sea, you know, boarding a ship, taking a look and saying yes or no, this is fine.
Yeah, that's also like a huge like time commitment if you're being inspected. I mean, I don't think the British would want their goods delayed for days potentially because of a German inspection or even an American inspection for that matter.
Depending on what's on it, that this could be very time sensitive stuff. You're talking about, you know, transporting food material. Who knows? A delay might cause a huge issue with that. So Britain responded that steam technology made the old inspection rules obsolete, since they could continue sailing in weather that would not allow for stopping and searching them. They're saying, hey, but this makes it harder, so I should be able to break the rules.
That sounds like the police trying to do like detective work on the internet.
Very much so. I mean, you see a lot of parallels with Britain justifying their blockade and the police justifying basically anything they do. Edward Trimble criticized the fast and loose rules by saying, if a war occurred today, a belligerent could, with allied precedent, justify almost any conceivable practice.
That man can see the future.
Yeah, that sounds very similar to anyone who has, you know, paid attention to how wars develop in the 21st century. The idea of, you know, this is not an invasion. This is a police action.
Right.
This is not a POW. This is a, I don't know, what do we call them? An enemy combatant.
Yeah.
This is not an unprovoked attack. This is a
preemptive.
Preemptive. So, of course, once the U.S. entered the war in 1917, we jumped right in and joined the embargo, the embargo that we had been complaining about for 3 years. Now that it was on our side, we were fine with it. It happens. And something I didn't know, the blockade didn't end with the armistice in November of 1918.
Really?
No.
I didn't know that either.
So like many things, like we talked about with the high seas fleet at Scapa Flow, it wasn't set in stone that the war was going to be for sure over. You know, it was an armistice. It was a ceasefire. There's still the outside possibility that Germany's going to pop back up in the eighth round and take a few swings.
Right.
And that was kind of the justification for continuing the embargo until March of 1919.
That is pretty crazy. I did not know that either, but it does check out with what I do know, that basically Germany just gets absolutely put through the ringer in this.
We say at the beginning of this war, it develops very much like any European war from the previous few hundred years. And, you know, yet by the end of it, Germany is basically crucified for participating in something that everyone else did too.
Right.
They just happen to be unsuccessful. And I mean, I think looking at this realistically, you have to understand how this engendered bitterness among just the average German. Mm-hmm. The idea that, you know, I'm a civilian anyway, I can't get food even when the war's over.
Right. Yeah.
We can't eat, we can't get food. My kids are still starving and the war's been over for 3 or 4 months. Yeah, I think you'd have to be like willfully ignorant to not understand why that would make a whole country bitter and susceptible to the kind of rhetoric that comes in the 20s and into the 30s.
Yeah, it does make a lot of sense that you've created a condition for that to manifest.
People are going to grab onto anything that's going to get them out of that.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of a discussion of the blockade I thought was interesting. So I want to move here to something after the sinking of the Lusitania that we kind of alluded to, and that's the Lusitania riots of 1915. So there was a lot of stuff that I wanted to cover specifically on the United States that we're going to, I think, move to the side, and maybe we'll talk about it sometime. I'm mainly going to focus here on Britain and South Africa.
Okay. I wasn't expecting to hear South Africa.
Where you really did have relatively large scale rioting happen in the aftermath of Lusitania. So we'll begin this part of the story in Britain itself. I think my note's supposed to say Gullis here, but I called her Nicoletta, which is like what I tell my students. You don't ever, ever, ever do that.
Call a writer by their first name.
Yeah. I was probably meaning to write her full name here. But she highlights the outbreak of ethnic tension as early as August 1914. Being officially at war, people in Britain didn't need the Lusitania to distrust and dislike the Germans.
Mm-hmm.
The Lusitania did, however, motivate more violent outbursts than just this kind of simmering distrust that had been there before.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even with as many people who are on the Lusitania, even those who weren't British necessarily, they had some sort of connection. That's kind of why they were on the ship. You know, maybe it's family or business, some other personal reason. Even the ones who aren't British citizens have connections. That's going to be felt in Britain.
Yeah, I feel like you see that in a lot of the stories of the passengers, that a lot of them are British, but like you said, a lot of them have business dealings and something like a Charles Laureate. You know what I mean? Like, was he actually British? Or was he American?
No, he was American, but he obviously took a lot of trips back and forth.
Right. And so like very culturally British, even though he's American, you know,
the cross-cultural nature of his job, you know, taking these British books and bringing them back to the United States. And also things like the community of dock workers and sailors and people who worked with and on these ships. That's a significant chunk of a city like Liverpool. If one of these ships goes down, that's going to affect whole neighborhoods, the whole sector of, you know, the dockyards and things like that.
Not to mention, especially in the United States, I know, and I'm assuming in Britain as well, at the time, there's a lot of German immigrants, and they're like a lot of the new people on the block. So they're taking the worst jobs, they're driving down wages, things like that. They're not popular amongst the working class of somewhere like the United States or Britain either, for that reason.
As we'll see later in South Africa, these riots, these don't sort of just develop as this sort of like mindless mob, but it's pretty focused, sometimes shockingly well-articulated hate from, you know, middle and upper class speakers and writers who were doing these things. It's kind of triggered by this thing, but this isn't just a knee-jerk reaction. There's some level of reason to this, at least at the beginning. So on hearing of the sinking of the Lusitania, the writer D.H. Lawrence wrote,
"I would like to kill 1 million Germans. 2 million.
And I think that's so interesting coming from D.H. Lawrence, you know, the guy who wrote Sons and Lovers and Lady Chatterley's Lover, and he's respected as like one of the finest English language writers. His books have a lot of depth, you know, that he's not like some pulp writer. Having this raw emotion of, I want to kill 1 million Germans, 2 million Germans.
Yeah, I looked up his picture. He gives me like kind English professor vibes.
Yeah, so you have people of his quote unquote caliber expressing these. That's a pretty barbaric thing to say, you know, at this time. And it kind of shows how, I don't know, maybe how the war is changing people a little bit.
I think the only comparison that maybe people, especially around our age, have is obviously 9/11, right? Mm-hmm. I know, like, if I go back and watch something from 2002 or 2003, there's some stuff in there sometimes that I'm like, wait, what? Like, this was just normal? Like, it's something that would look so out of place today, but you're getting it from people you'd have never expected it from, you know? Mm-hmm. It's weird seeing, like, Barry Manilow being like, yeah, bomb Iraq. You know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly. people that I had no idea this person was so violent.
Yeah, I didn't know you had that take in you there, Barry. I have no idea if Barry Manilow ever actually said that, so.
I doubt it, but I don't know.
I'm scared.
There's a lot of weird stuff happening at the time.
To look it up. Yeah, right.
So another commentator here was Oliver P. Bernard, who was a scenic artist who was in Queenstown at the time of the sinking.
A terrible picture. A picture of haunting horror at a temporary mortuary in Queenstown. A number of babies, I could say about 30, were laid out stiff and stark. I hope these tiny mites will be fully avenged.
He's a little bit less explicit about what he means by that, but you kind of get the same sense of he would probably agree with D.H. Lawrence here.
Yeah, I feel like he took the other route. Instead of saying, I just want to kill all the Germans, it's like, look at this horrible thing they did. I think we all know what we should do about this.
Mm-hmm. Pat O'Mara, who had several friends on board among the crew, he wrote about what he observed after the sinking was announced in Liverpool.
It took about 2 days for the names of the drowned among the crew to be published. They were terrible. We walked around Scotland Road listening to the cries of women whose husbands and sons had gone down with the Lucy, and we heard the bitter threats made against Germany and anything with a German name.
Americans who were alive in the aftermath of September 11th would recognize, in that case, not even against a specific group of people. I mean, obviously, a lot of anti-Islamic rhetoric, mm-hmm. but just in general, that sort of reestablishing of American quote-unquote patriotism. Like, that's when we started doing the national anthem before football games. There was the whole debacle with people, you know, freedom fries, whatever.
I think also, I like that they include, like, anything with a German name, because I remember that, I mean, bringing it to the 9/11 comparison, it didn't matter if you were anything from Armenian to Pakistani. Mm-hmm. Like, it didn't matter if you were slightly different. You were getting looks. We lived in Chicago at the time, so, you know, there was all sorts of different, you know, cultures and ethnicities there. And it was really interesting to see people who weren't Muslim, weren't Arab, they, you know, weren't even from the Middle East, and they were still targets of this because they looked slightly different. We weren't even sure who to be angry at.
It's such a frustrating onion of racism because, like, okay, even if you had the right, even if this person was the right religion or from the right country that you're trying to be angry at, that's still not right. They didn't do it.
Right. So I'm picturing some poor Swiss man getting yelled at for having a German name at this point.
I mean, it's things like that. That especially we'll see some examples later. The author of that article we're quoting, Gullis, she writes, O'Mara and his neighbors did begin to weld their ethnically diverse neighbors into an imagined community of a different sort. One that elided the butcher down the street with the U-boat captain who sank the Lusitania, and ultimately the Kaiser himself, with the malign personification of a Prussian spirit for which local shopkeepers would now bear responsibility. So O'Mara described the beginning of the riots as follows.
On the corner of Scotland Road, ominous gangs were gathering. Men and women, very drunk and very angry. Suddenly something crashed up the road. A pork butcher's had their front windows kicked in with a brick, and a crowd of men and women were wrecking the place. Everything suggestive of Germany was being smashed to pieces.
So Gullis describes the riots having a generally xenophobic nature to them, just as much as an anti-German one. Naturalized citizens were attacked, ethnic English who were married to Germans, people with, quote, suspicious sounding names.
This all feels so familiar.
So these latter often ended up hailing from exotic places like Yorkshire and Scotland. So Russians, Belgians, other ethnicities who were present but maybe couldn't be differentiated from Germans, or maybe they could, but they weren't recognized as allies in this case.
Mm-hmm. I think that's interesting. That's like kind of what I was talking about. Like, you know, at this point, if you're Belgian, that's close enough to being German in the same way that, you know, if you were, say, Armenian, oh, well, you look kind of like them. You know what I mean? Like, it's the same thing, even though you're nothing remotely the same. And like you said, even if you were, that doesn't solve the problem.
At best, you don't look like me, and that's what I can recognize right now.
Right, exactly.
O'Mara includes a very telling anecdote about a particular butcher shop. He's writing about a point where the rioters are being led by someone he nicknames Joan of Arc, a female chip chopper. I don't know what that is. Is it someone who makes, like, fries?
It feels like a really British word.
A chip chopper? A female chip chopper by the name of Mrs. Seymour.
If any of our British listeners can tell us what a chip chopper is, please get in touch. Mr. Yag was a big, wholesome fellow who allegedly had been born in Germany. Two of his nephews at the time were with my cousin Bernie and the 8th Irish over in France. I always liked Mr. Yag, but not quite so keenly as I'd like to break his window without fear of molestation. As we converged on the big shop, Mr. Yag, arms akimbo, came out, pipe in his mouth with his usual broad smile. This vanished instantly as someone kicked him in the belly and a volley of bricks sent into the huge window. "You'll sink the bleeding Lucy, will ya?" yelled our Joan, waving a shillelagh over his prostrate form.
So you have this sudden sort of restructuring of society. So you have groups like the Irish, who obviously they have their qualms, they have their some disagreements with the British throughout history, but they share more culture than they do with some of these other groups.
Mm-hmm.
Groups like the Irish, who previously they'd been on the receiving end of this negative opinion from the British, they suddenly found themselves in the majority. They're suddenly part of the dominant group after so often not being in that group. Suddenly they are, because there's someone else who's going to have it worse.
Yeah, I think, I mean, you're seeing that anytime you can put a group below you, that means you're not the bottom group, right? I think that explains so much in the like poor Southern white voting patterns in American history, right?
I think on a more individual level, it also explains things like, you know, if you go to a high school or a middle school, some of the meanest, cruelest people you'll meet are people who get bullied themselves.
Right.
Because as soon as they find someone who is, you know, at a lower rung or someone that they feel that they can be on top of, they will transfer that venom straight to the next person down the ladder.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I think that's such a natural human thing, right? Like you see it in your workplace, right? The first time someone gets a little bit of power,
mm-hmm.
and they're going to take out every issue they've ever had on their poor, you know, subordinates.
Here, we're just seeing that same thing in mass. You know, suddenly, hey, we're not the ones being oppressed. We're not the ones being talked down to. We have someone else that we can do that to.
Mm-hmm.
So quoting here again, "For the Irish slum dwellers, the sinking of the Lusitania allowed them to refashion, momentarily, an Irish identity that had always been cast in opposition to England. Their German neighbors, on the other hand, lost their ability to define themselves as anything but German." So on May 11th, Viscount Sandhurst wrote in his diary about the anti-German riots sweeping the country.
"The rioting in East London continued with great violence today. Any German shops being wrecked, and in some cases, any with a foreign name. Porters and carriers at Smithfield have joined the boycott. One supposed to have declared he wouldn't move a German meal." Ugh, I'm going to have to start that
also,
over.
Also, that's supposed to say carcass instead of caress.
Where is that at?
He says, "I wouldn't move a German meal if a carcass were hung round with diamonds."
Oh. Some of the phrasing in these older things is so hard.
It's carcass.
How do you spell carcass? There it is, carcass. "Porters and carriers at Smithfield have joined the boycott. One supposed to have declared he wouldn't move a German meal if a carcass were hung around with diamonds. German butchers, bakers, and tobacconists, shops demolished and looted. Troops and 30,000 special constables called out, and a great deal of scuffling and many heads broken by batons." I am sure that those 30,000 special constables were just upright, fine, perfectly adjusted citizens, right?
This is the best day of their career.
Like, you know, some of them got that call, like, absolutely, yes. Mm-hmm.
So cooler heads, probably no less angry about the sinking, sought to direct the anger in the right direction, or at very least away from innocent civilians.
Mm-hmm.
So English feminist and socialist Sylvia Pankhurst wrote, "It's a ghastly, cruel happening, an unjust catastrophe brought down upon the innocent and helpless. But shall we revenge ourselves on other helpless people who are living in our midst, and who are no more to blame either for the sinking of Lusitania or for the war than we ourselves? This is no patriotism." So there were subsequent legal crackdowns, but not against the rioters.
Of course.
Against the German community instead. So Germans, even naturalized citizens of Britain, were banned from the London Stock Exchange. Measures were taken to prevent Germans from changing or anglicizing their surnames. Yeah, even if you are choosing not to identify as German, you're not allowed to do that. We want to make sure that we still know who you are.
Yeah, that is interesting. And I know we'll, like, you see it later with like Japanese internment and stuff in America during World War II. Some of the most patriotic citizens are the ones that get treated the worst, like people that truly believe in whatever culture they're trying to assimilate to.
Especially because, you know, a good portion of those people immigrating are probably immigrating because they don't like the direction their country's going in. They don't like the rampant increasing militarism that they're seeing in Germany. They don't want to get drafted into a war if one breaks out like they think it's going to. That's exactly why they've left.
Right.
And now you're basically ideologically pushing them back there because they have nowhere else to go in the cases where that happened. So there is widespread internment of ethnically German males from 17 to 55 with the expulsion and repatriation of older Germans.
That is not something I've ever heard about before.
I don't know. Like, I don't know the extent to which that was done. I don't know if that was like a very widespread, very thorough internment. It could just be something I've not heard of before. I don't know if it was quite to the extent that the United States did to Japanese Americans in
Second World War. Yeah, it's a lot different if you're just like on constant probation and have to check in versus like
literally being in a camp.
You live here now. Yeah, you live here now.
Which is functionally a concentration camp. We don't call them that to make ourselves feel better. We call them internment camps, but that's what those were. It was a way to keep people concentrated.
Right.
Speaking of concentration camps.
Oh, no.
Let's talk about the British in South Africa. The original concentration camps.
It's actually only a concentration camp if it comes from South Africa.
So in South Africa. South Africa here is interesting from a demographic perspective. We're going to focus on the white South African population. Obviously, any discussion about South Africa, you go into it with the underlying knowledge that there's a massive majority of the population that's not included in this conversation. The native South Africans. Here, we're looking at the white South African population divided roughly between the British and the Afrikaners. So even though we kind of think of the Afrikaners as being Dutch, just Dutch in South Africa, and that's largely true, German immigrants are estimated to have made up about a third of those who would later identify as Afrikaners.
Interesting. I thought the only Germans that identified as Afrikaners came later.
Some of those too. So there was a significant blending of the populations so that it was more difficult to distinguish between who's German and who is an Afrikaner. Fortunately for the British, they kind of have problems with both of them. So it doesn't really matter. The issue of identity is confusing to both insiders and outsiders. In some cases, Germans in South Africa may have treasured their regional origins more than their national roots. As in the case of a man dutifully reporting to a London police station, he indicated his nationality as Bavarian, to which the reply was, "Go away, we don't want you, we want only Germans."
I didn't even think about that as we're talking about it, but like even the concept of Germany is still pretty fresh.
It's a recent thing. I mean, if you know, say a middle-aged person at this point, you very well may not think of yourself as German. That might not be an identity that sticks with you. You might think of yourself as, "I'm Prussian, I'm Bavarian."
Well, I feel like when we hear German, especially German military, how often is that kind of code for Prussian, actually?
Oh, yeah. I mean, almost entirely in, you know, late 1800s, they've kind of become one and the same.
And I think that it could be where you get someone who is from Bavaria, and they're like, well, obviously we don't mean you.
Yeah, I mean, even through the First World War, Bavaria had a technically separate, like, royalty. You had, like, the Crown Prince of Bavaria. He was a commander in the Western Front. They kind of historically always had that extra independence from whatever polity they were part of. So yeah, you could see someone Bavarian identifying as Bavarian rather than German.
You think all the German people traveling were doing like what Americans do? We don't want to say we're Americans. We're like, we're from Canada. They're like, we're from Austria. We're Austrian. Yeah. We are not German.
Probably. So Afrikaners were also divided on political grounds. So we have to go all the way back to the Boer War here.
Bet you guys didn't think you were going to hear about the Boer War in Lusitania, did you?
So at the end of the Boer War, this is the second Boer War. The first Boer War basically just establishes that there's probably going to be a second Boer War. And it also wasn't very long. Usually when people talk about the Boer War, they're talking about the second one. So at the end of the second Boer War, or the South African War, it's sometimes called, Louis Botha, who was the prime minister of the South African Union, and Jan Christian Smuts, the defense minister. Those names both sound Afrikaner. It's because they are both considered major heroes of the Afrikaner resistance during the war. Once the war's over and the shooting stops, they collaborated pretty closely with the British and secured power for themselves. I mean, it's very odd. This is a matter of about 12 years between these things, and you've got Afrikaner rebels. They had basically been at that point. Now they're running the country and they're hand in glove with Britain.
Interesting.
And you can kind of see how that might rub some Afrikaners the wrong way, saying we spent years fighting these guys. They put us in freaking concentration camps, man. Like, right. And Also, the Boer War is also one of those tough wars where truly not a good side in the
right,
Boer War.
Yeah, there is. It is one of those. It's like the worst people you know are all fighting.
This is truly two groups of white people fighting over who is allowed to extract resources from this indigenous population.
Right.
Absolutely not a good side in the Boer War. The idea that these, you know, these guys that they had followed into battle, they had agreed to this ceasefire, and then they had basically just joined the oppressors in the eyes of some of these Afrikaners, not wanting to support Britain. They were kind of reluctant to be taken in by all this anti-German propaganda that Britain was pushing out.
Lord Kitchener, whose name most Afrikaners associated with the farm burnings and concentration camps of the South African War, were repulsed by the unheroic slaughter in the trenches, which were seen as another German invention.
Lord Kitchener, who's all over the early part of World War I for the British, he's in their propaganda stuff, he's in the Britain's Your Country Needs You poster, he's famous commander for British people. They're probably associating him both with the Boer War, but also in the Sudan. He's kind of the guy who makes that not so much of a mess for Britain. But to the Afrikaners, they associate him with horrendous war crimes. And they're not going to follow this guy or trust this guy when he tells them that someone is their enemy. A great example of this is the Maritz Rebellion, sometimes just called the Afrikaner Rebellion. That had been put down earlier in 1915. Lieutenant Colonel Monty Maritz of South Africa's Union Defense Force had been ordered to invade German Southwest Africa, a theater of the war that doesn't always get a lot of attention. But yeah, World War I was in fact a world war. It spilled over all over the place, and it was happening in Southwest Africa. So on being ordered to invade German territory, Maritz refused to obey the order. He refused attempts at being replaced as commander, and ultimately just straight up allied himself with the Germans.
I love the idea of just like refusing to not be commander anymore. Be like, nah, I'm good. I'll stay here.
And you kind of have to think that there's a little bit of panic for the British right now, because like these guys that we just got done fighting, like just a little over a decade ago, decided to trust these guys. We gave them weapons. Now there's 10,000 of them in not just rebellion, but, you know, joining our enemies on the other side of the border. So that rebellion would be put down. A great example of a figure from the Afrikaner community who would influence others to join this rebellion is a guy named Christian de Wet.
Why do they all have such messed up names?
You ever heard of Christian de Wet?
I don't think so.
So he had fought in both Boer Wars and with special distinction in the second. He had led a guerrilla campaign that made him sort of into a boogeyman for the British, a guy they couldn't pin down. You know, they'd, you know, have him surrounded and he would escape. He was, you know, outnumbered 10 to 1 and they could never quite get him. His name kind of became a byword for resisting the British Empire.
He's like the Francis Marion of this.
Probably not a terrible comparison. They're probably equally racist, I'm guessing.
They probably are.
De Wet, he was a prominent Afrikaner who joined the Maritz Rebellion and served in a leadership role. Again, he's a name that people knew. If he was going along with this, a lot of Afrikaners were going to go along with this. That gave it a lot of legitimacy. He'd be captured in November 1914. You know, he's an older guy, probably not quite as sneaky anymore. He was sentenced to 6 years imprisonment, but released after just one with a written promise that he would stay retired. Do you know the song Monto by the Dubliners?
I think I've heard it before. I've heard a lot of their stuff.
It starts the, well, if you've got a wingo, take her up to Ringo.
Yeah, yeah, I've heard that.
It's one that's sung by Luke Kelly. Christian de Wet is actually mentioned in that song.
Oh, really?
By name. There's a line, you've seen the Dublin Fusiliers, the dirty old bamboozleers. De Wet will kill the Childers 1, 2, 3. Or Chislers in some of the lines. So that's a direct reference to this guy, Christian de Wet, that a lot of people would recognize by name. Next line is, marching from the Linen Hall, there's one for every cannonball. Vicky's going to send them all over the sea. Kind of laughing at the fact that, oh, good luck, guys. You're going to go. You get to go fight Christian de Wet. So, yeah, obviously you have sort of Irish reveling in the fact that Britain can't deal with this guy. Just a fun little fact there. So we spoke mainly about the effect of Lusitania sinking on the United States in the main series. But to understand Lusitania riots, we have to see the war from a wider perspective of the nations who are already involved.
The torpedoing of the Lusitania occurred only weeks after the German army had used poison gas on the Western Front for the first time, and days after British newspapers reported that the German troops in Southwest Africa had been poisoning wells.
So yeah, for someone already engaged and plugged into this, who's going to be on the lookout for these things, Lusitania is just kind of, you know, it's still shocking, but it's just another atrocity.
Mm-hmm.
It's a fact that the Germans did kill civilians in Belgium. That was a war crime, sure, but it was kind of I could see this happening, whereas Lusitania was just kind of like, this is unimaginable that you could kill this many civilians.
And yeah, the war crimes like in Belgium are the type of war crimes that have happened since war's probably been a thing.
Yeah, just kind of troops working out their frustrations on a civilian population. And then, of course, yeah, you have the issue with poison gas being deployed. You know, first by the Germans, but obviously not only by the Germans.
Mm-hmm.
Yet another example of how one side breaks a rule, other side is saying, well, we get to do it too.
Mm-hmm.
So the sinking was reported in Johannesburg on May 8th, and this news was followed by reports of anti-German rioting in Britain. Against the background of a flag flying half-mast at many public buildings, enraged Johannesburg citizens collected signatures. Petitioners were urged to sign while wiping their boots on a German flag, and called upon the mayor to take measures against German residents. The first act of violence occurred when a German patron of the Anglo-Austrian Cafe refused to take his hat off when the British national anthem was played.
That's such an odd thing, but like, also totally conceivable in like a post 9/11 world for like,
oh, right,
someone not standing up and taking their hat off like when the national anthem played before the World Series on TV.
You see what happens to Americans when a football player kneels during the national anthem. Yeah, put it in the context of wartime, for sure you could see this happening.
Yeah, it's funny how silly it sounds until you think, you're like, well, no, actually, like this makes sense. I see how this happens.
Can't overstate this. This is one guy not standing for the national anthem. One dude in this cafe. This set off a crowd of a few thousand marching, singing patriotic songs, and looking for German businesses to target.
It's like they just finally found their opportunity.
The nights of May 12th and 13th saw flag burning, furniture smashing, and other acts of destruction. Observers noted that this wasn't an unruly mob and instead were, quote, baffled by the preponderance of a decent middle-class element in the rampaging hordes, where women were often noticed to be active participants.
Interesting that they note that.
MP for the Labour Party Tommy Boydell, observing the riots in Durban.
These were men and women engaged in this wicked and wanton destruction from all walks of social life. It was no rabble or mob that was doing it, although in every separate crowd there was a rough element, but they were in a very small minority. It was a most reasonable crowd, committing the most unreasonable acts.
And in all of these, there's always that little undercurrent of classism.
Mm-hmm.
They're rioting, but they're not even poor. What? What?
But they own the local jet ski dealership.
Right. Exactly. So often we see this, how the ones who are causing all the problems aren't this, you know, poor, unheard mass. You know, this is someone who's probably decently well off.
The local small business tyrant, basically.
Also, you know, being surprised that there's so many women doing this also. Mm-hmm. Like so many things we talk about with the First World War, kind of the, obviously not the end of a class system in Britain or anywhere else, mm-hmm. but certainly a blurring of some of those lines where some of that privilege of class is gone.
Mm-hmm.
You know, your graduating from Eton doesn't stop you from getting cut in half by a machine gun.
Yeah, there's a certain leveling of the playing field, isn't there?
And here we kind of see the same thing in a civilian context of it doesn't matter if you are well off or not. You're still running through the streets, rioting and smashing windows.
Mm-hmm.
So the enthusiasm of the police to step in was questioned. Again, being in the United States, we have totally seen instances where the police selectively choose to stand back and let something happen. You know, if they... the Proud Boys or someone are rioting and smashing the storefronts, the cops maybe don't want to go in because they don't want to shoot one of their coworkers. You see it sometimes. And this is an example here. Quoting again, high-ranking police officers admitted that they succeeded in motivating their understaffed force to protect Germans only after long arguments when it was pointed out to them that not only German subjects, but also British subjects were concerned, and that we had a big native population who might chip in.
Some things never change, right?
It's a beautiful thing when one racism cancels out the other or supplants the other. And yeah, you kind of see that those changing levels of solidarity. We talked about the Irish and British showing solidarity with each other when normally they hate each other. Mm-hmm. And then here, once you introduce that native element, since we're in South Africa, mm-hmm. well, suddenly it's okay. We white people have to stick together, because right. if we don't, the natives are going to get agitated and take advantage of it. So the bulk of the damage done to property fell, kind of unsurprisingly, I think, on British and Allied property, to the tune of £381,083.
Mm.
Compare that with £152,308 worth of damage belonging to German residents.
Yeah, it's interesting that so often in any kind of a riot or mob action, the thing that sparks it's never really the thing people are even doing. Like, it's just that act of destruction that's so important. What's being destroyed really isn't all that important, like, to the rioters themselves.
And what's interesting here, I was kind of surprised by this the whole time, and I can't actually think of an example that I saw, is that there's basically no targeting of individuals.
So it's all property crime?
It's property damage that's going on.
Interesting.
Here. Windows being smashed and machines being broken. We saw that one where the German butcher comes out and he's waving and then they kick him in the stomach.
Mm-hmm.
But again, like, they didn't kill him. They didn't, you know, beat him on the ground. It was just he was in the way of them trying to smash his store.
That is interesting, because you read the accounts of, like, the pogroms and stuff in Russia and targeting Jewish people, and, like, they don't play out like that. Like, they're very different. Yeah, and it's different. Like,
it doesn't really make it that much better. It's right. still a terrifying experience for everyone involved there, but it does give a kind of a unique flavor to this, where it does seem to be, you know, venting this on property. Mm-hmm. And then as you read these accounts, I'll share the article, because there's a lot more blow by blow in there. It is very much an instance where the crowd will get to a shop, smash the windows, smash what they can, and just go to the next one. There's no sort of, like, lingering destruction.
It's interesting too that, like, also, like you said, when they start bringing up, like, the native population, it's like, all right, guys, you had your fun. We let you smash up some storefronts. Like, let's get serious now. Like, mm-hmm. let's keep our eye on what the overall goal is here.
So, like any mob action, there's complications in identifying who they're supposed to be even targeting. Who are they mm-hmm. really even mad at, and where are they? The owner of the Elite Bioscope in Johannesburg could not prevent the destruction of her property by pointing out to the crowd that she was French and her husband British. So we'll see another possible mistaken identity in the next segment, where we look at one South African city in particular. And this is Pieter Maritzburg.
I refuse to believe that's a real place.
In a lot of it, I think they just call it Maritzburg. So this is going to happen on the 13th and 14th of May. So those, I think we said, started on the 10th. And also there, we saw one of the key factors in setting it off was news of riots in Britain arriving in South Africa, saying, hey, they're doing it there. We should be doing this here. Learning from their older brothers. Pieter Maritzburg was a medium-sized city of about 15,000 people in 1915,
mm-hmm.
located in the province of Natal. Natal was, quote, the most English of South Africa's provinces, in that the majority of the European population was of British birth or descent.
I feel like that's some coded language.
And I think by that he means identifying as British, rather than saying I'm South African, I'm British. For this one, my main source was from Paul Thompson, writing in War and Society, is the name of this journal. So by the end of 1915, about 1,000 men from the area would serve in either British or South African Union forces. So if you put that in perspective of the overall population of the city at 15,000, 1,000 men serving, that's an enormous percentage of the population.
Yeah, that really is.
So there had been reports of German atrocities committed in Belgium and France, but the sinking of Lusitania tipped public opinion past just, you know, displeasure, distrust, and into just open, sometimes blind rage. The newspaper The Natal Witness called out Pieter Maritzburg's mayor, Percy Taylor, for not gathering to express public indignation quickly enough, as had been done in Durban and Johannesburg. Everyone's kind of competing to be the most anti-German.
That is, like, you still see that today, right? It's interesting to see that play out like at a slower speed, like when there's no social media, but it's like, man, it's been a couple of days. Like, where's your statement?
Oh yeah, for sure. Any event that happens, why are you being silent about this? And it's like, I don't know. I didn't know that much about it. Didn't want to say anything. A lot of stuff going on. There was a nationwide railway men's petition that asked the government to expel all employees of German extraction. This was signed in Pietermaritzburg on May 12th. Following morning, Maritzburg papers carried news of the riots that had occurred in other cities in South Africa and in Britain. Again, as news of this spreads, the concept spreads. Thompson notes that neither the Times nor the Witness spoke out against or condemned the riots. Both newspapers reported local groups of Germans meeting to toast the sinking of the Lusitania, further agitating patriotic citizens. So you have these stories of at such and such German pub, at such and such cafe, there was a group of 10 guys and they were drinking to the health of the Kaiser and they were laughing and celebrating about the sinking of the Lusitania.
That very much has like the same energy as like they were partying in every mosque on, you know, the evening of 9/11.
Quite honestly, the exact same type of story where you hear the story and then it's, you know, it's for some reason people can't verify which mosque it was or how many people were there or any of the names of the people who were supposed to be doing this.
But it definitely happened.
Everyone heard it from someone.
Right, right.
So the riots in Pietermaritzburg started on the evening of Thursday, May 13th, as about 30 men gathered on Church Street. Quoting here, these included Joe Goddard, a railway shop man, with a big drum, a man with an old cavalry bugle, and several men carrying Union Jacks. Other men carried an effigy of a German soldier, decorated with an iron cross and draped in black. They carried torches and iron staves. Their avowed purpose was to wreck places of German business. Joe Goddard, beating the drum, led the crowd down the street. They sang, "It's a long way to Tipperary, as we go marching on, and rule Britannia."
Those guys, like, don't know it, but they would have loved Brexit if they were back in England.
It's supposed to be an ominous situation here, but for some reason, the drum just makes it funny. I don't know.
They're just so aggressively, like, British in South Africa. It's very interesting.
So in response to this gathering, police did begin to prepare to deal with unrest. Colonel Richard S. Godley of the South African Police was the superior officer on scene. Also, Chief Constable Barron of the Borough Police was involved. You'll see his name come up also in dealing with this. Kind of an overlapping jurisdiction. So you've got the National Police and you've got the local police. Obviously, sometimes they don't mesh super well. You've just got two independent commands operating on the same territory. But Godley kind of takes command here. Soon, the growing demonstration was in the center of town and outnumbered police by an estimated 50-1. Seeing his men at such a disadvantage, Godley considered calling for reinforcements from the South African Veteran Regiment, saying this has graduated from a police problem to an army problem. Godley decided against calling for this support after some quick consideration, mainly because of what those soldiers were guarding. This regiment was stationed at Fort Napier, adjacent to the city, and Godley identified Fort Napier itself as a possible target for the demonstrators because it served as a German internment camp.
Oh, yeah, I feel like they almost wanted that to happen then, didn't they?
Thinking worst case scenario, if these guys try to get to the internment camp and, I don't know, try to break in to get at them, you've got that as an issue in itself, and you've got potentially our prisoners escaping.
Right. Like, he's thinking, like, I can't have these people, I can't have a bunch of murders, like, basically on me.
Right. Exactly. I can't let that happen. So police used a tactic that we would recognize from protests today of deploying detectives in plain clothes among the crowd to identify specific ringleaders or notable agitators.
Interesting.
Hopefully they blended better than cops seem to blend at protests. Around 7:25 in the evening, the crowd began to attack enemy property in earnest. The first business to fall victim was a photographer's shop owned by Ernst Gossler. Gossler, presumably thinking ahead, had removed most of his stuff. So really, the windows were the only thing damaged.
It's a good day.
And you see that in several occasions where they'll break into a shop and there's essentially nothing there.
Yeah, I feel like it's almost more of a formality thing. It's like, you know, we have to do this.
There's that, and obviously this news has been spreading. If you're reading the papers and you are a person of German extraction, you see what's happening in London, you see what's happening in Liverpool, and in Johannesburg, you probably have an idea what's going to happen here.
Mm-hmm.
Next up was the Tim brothers, provision merchants. But at this point, the police arrived and were able to move the demonstrators away with only damage to the exterior.
Nice.
At this point, the crowd is at about 800 to 1,000 people. Henry Nizavan's optician shop was broken into, and all his equipment demolished. So we finally have some expensive stuff to break.
Right. Yeah. Don't want to miss that.
This actually included some meteorological equipment that he had in an observatory attached to his shop. A brick was put through the window of the tobacconist next door by the name of Nielsen, who was not German, but in fact, Norwegian.
To have like a big Norwegian flag up. Like, no, I'm that.
Also, this shop wasn't entered. So this is one where could have legitimately just been a misthrown brick. Mm-hmm. Smashing the window could have been someone was going to go at it and someone pointed out, hey, this guy's Norwegian. He's not even German. Leave him alone.
It's interesting, too. Like, you know, going back to that butcher story, like all of these people, they all know each other. Mm-hmm. Like they've had no animosity necessarily towards their neighbors and stuff until this happens. And then it doesn't matter. Like, it doesn't matter if you are one of the quote unquote good ones at this point.
Yeah. Great example. That quote that you read from O'Mara talking about that butcher saying, oh, yeah, like I knew this guy. He's got a nephew or whatever. He's serving with my cousin over in France right now. Yeah, I kicked him in the stomach.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, maybe some of that did come from the fact that the rioters in their head are only targeting property. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to kill the guy. I just want to break his window.
Right.
Across the street, the shop of Schwacke and Company was targeted.
It never had a chance, did it?
This was a jeweler and a watchmaker, so plenty of now we're getting to the expensive stuff.
Yeah, this is the good stuff for the rioters.
Protesters entered and smashed the contents of the store before being stopped by the police. Now with the crowd up to about 1,200, it split into a few different sections and moved in different directions. The riot has metastasized now.
Yeah, that's not good.
I'm reminded of, I think it was someone with like the LAPD or someone talking about riots and civil unrest and saying, you know, we can deal with one riot of 1,000 people, no problem.
Mm-hmm.
We can't deal with 10 riots of 100 people.
Right. Yeah, because the amount of force you have to deploy to contain 10 different incidents, mm-hmm. like that, like, you just can't be everywhere.
This is becoming a real problem now because this is much harder to contain. So from here, we'll kind of end the blow-by-blow account. It's a lot of the same stuff. Moving down the street, smashing a shop, moving on, when the police show up to sort of usher you down. And again, that maybe has something to do with the fact that people weren't targeted, you know, even presumably some of these shopkeepers probably trying to resist,
mm-hmm.
because you kind of have the police following along and keeping them moving, basically saying, hey, as long as they're smashing windows, they're not killing people.
Yeah, I do feel like that was almost what that was, right? Is an attempt to keep them moving and being like, all right, they're doing things that are bad, but they're not actually trying to hurt or kill anyone. Like, let them get it out of their system, but keep it contained to this.
Right. At that point, the story kind of becomes less linear. You've got these different bands moving through the city. That's all in the article I'll share, though. There was a second round of demonstration the following day. So this is Friday the 14th. Attempts had been made at the local and national level to prevent more unrest.
Colonel Godley and Chief Constable Barron agreed that further rioting should be dealt with severely. Foot police of the SAP, absent on detachment or leave, were called in. Six guards were sent from the fort. Mounted police were called in from the country. Godley wired SAP headquarters in Pretoria for permission to enroll special constables, which was given. And he called for volunteers from the local rifle associations. He was disappointed when only 60 men came forward. Godley also ordered all bars and licensed premises to close at 6 that evening and stopped telephone calls and telegrams from Durban, where much of the violence had occurred. This was in order to prevent any cooperation between rioters in the two centers. The government imposed a nationwide ban on the news of riots in other centers.
Here we see some of these wartime liberties being taken by the government and being applied to a civilian context of, we're going to cut off telegrams, we're going to cut off telephones.
Yeah, it is weird hearing that and thinking like, oh, that makes sense why you'd want to do that. But then when you hear like, China restricts their internet, and you're like, wow, it's like a totalitarian regime. But you're like, is it any different, really?
Absolutely not. It's the same thing. Or, you know, in especially the protests in the summer of 2020, such a big thing was, you know, the police would have those trucks pull up and, you know, jam cell phone signals.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, classic move there. With carefully worded coverage, the Natal Witness deprecated destruction of property on principle as un-British. yet condoned it on grounds of extreme provocation. The riot was not really a riot. No one had been attacked, no looting had taken place, and no one had resisted the police. Therefore, it was a demonstration, whose righteous object should now be quite clear to the authorities.
It's so funny how these things never change.
Times of Natal had a little bit more measured and critical coverage. So they instead condemned the rioters for having done more damage to British-owned properties and put British employees out of work. Englishmen did not make war on women and children. So condemning it more from a pragmatic perspective, saying, well, you're ruining all of our stuff. And then also what I would take as I think a dig at Germany, saying we don't attack women and children.
Right.
We are better than that. So the turnout for the demonstrations on the 14th, significantly smaller than the previous night. It's included in the umbrella of the Lusitania riots. It's not a riot, really, by anyone's definition. Lots of possible reasons for that. You know, cooler heads. People had satiated their rage the night before. Worry about the increased police presence is another one. You know, they know just as well that there's this regiment of troops not far away. In that quote you read, they mentioned that there's a few guards that show up from there. There's mounted troopers now.
I think it's interesting, too, that the police kind of let them, within the bounds of what's okay, play out the riot and kind of get themselves nice and tired and get it all out. And then they have enough force to bring bear to Becky. If you guys want to keep doing it, you can. But like, we're fresh and you're not. So,
yeah, you could very well see, you know, if the police try to take more active steps that first night, that's going to engender more rage against them. And then who knows, that next night is probably more violent. So with the presence of mounted personnel, police are better able to contain and get ahead of the flow of marchers. You know, these groups that break off, well, you're not going to move faster than a mounted column, armed British soldiers. And, you know, these rioters signed up to smash a few windows, not to get into combat. So on Saturday, a large meeting of around 3,000 people took place at the town hall, calling on the government to enforce its policies on internment and trade and to purge the area of enemy aliens in business and government. Police remained on heightened alert throughout the weekend, but there was no more rioting. On Monday, media censorship ended and news of the other cities was allowed in. So in sum, of the 18 places visited by the rioters on 13 May, 6 were run by German nationals. 10 by naturalized German or Austrians, and 2 by citizens of neutral countries. Only Baumann and the Timms actually owned their buildings. And none of the other buildings were German-owned, so the cost of damages to structures fell mainly on the British.
Yeah, that's something I didn't think about either, and especially if like you got all of your store's property out. Like, what do you really care if you're renting, right?
Yeah, like, this is not my store. I don't care. I'll get a new window. It's not even mine.
Although, I don't know if I want to be a German ethnic person going to court against my landlord at this time. So, right. I don't know. Maybe they still found a way to make them pay.
So, that's kind of the big narrative I wanted to cover here. There's just a few more loose ends that I kind of just got fell between the cracks that I wanted to make sure we got to discuss quick. So, these are kind of unrelated miscellanea. One of them was William Jennings Bryan. I texted you right after we finished that episode. We talked about him, and we forgot somehow to make any reference to the Scopes trial.
I know. You sent that, and then I thought the same thing. I was like, huh, I am kind of surprised.
William Jennings Bryan, probably, I don't know, would you say he's most famous for the Scopes trial?
Probably in, like, popular culture, right? Like, to the extent that he is a known person. I feel like if there is a Jeopardy question about him, that would
probably
definitely
be involving
the
Scopes trial. Clarence Darrow famously was the defense for John Scopes in that trial. Kind of made a habit of defending the difficult to defend. He defended him. Didn't he defend Leopold and Loeb?
I believe he did, yeah.
He did something with the Eastland also. But anyway, William Jennings Bryan argued for the prosecution. And he died like less than a week after that. I didn't know that.
I did not know that either.
Yeah. He did not live long to revel in his victory. Another thing that came up interesting was the identity of who sank the Lusitania. We've talked about Walter Schwieger in the aftermath in the years and decades since that. Everyone knows Walter Schwieger sank the Lusitania. That wasn't 100% agreed on. We didn't have all the same information then that we have now. For some time after the sinking, some headlines, when I was looking at old newspaper headlines for this, some of them identify Max Valentiner as sinking the Lusitania instead. And interesting that they identify him by name, because he was a name that Americans, some of them, would have recognized as one of these evil submarine captains. Max Valentiner actually ended the war as the third most successful U-boat commander in terms of tonnage, just typically how they're measuring these things. Number of ships is less important than how much you're sinking. There were 144 ships that he could be blamed for, but Lusitania was not one of them. Walter Schwieger, obviously famous as the man who sank the biggest prize of the war, he ranked only 7th on the overall list. Part of this is explained by the fact that he had like a full year less than a lot of these guys.
This is true. This is true.
Because he's killed in September 1917. I was fascinated by this. The list stopped at 37. Uh-huh. I don't know why. I assume there's more than that, but maybe they're just not recorded. This is on uboat.net, by the way. People with suspicious interest in U-boats, I would say.
I do love the website as a reference tool.
It's very useful.
Much like when I play Panzer General, I just try not to think too much about all like the lore and the people that are a little too into it.
Love the website. Never want to talk to the person who runs it. The guy who ranked 37th, Ralph Venninger, that's the lowest the list goes. He sank 98 ships.
That's crazy.
37th place and you sank 98 ships.
Like Mr. Irrelevant here on the list.
The bench crew is almost sinking triple digit ships in the war, which is just, it just highlights just the enormous number of ships that are being sunk when commanders that aren't even noteworthy are sinking, you know, almost 100 ships. So we talked about some of the short fiction. I mentioned the Arthur Conan Doyle story, Danger. There's also one by Joseph Conrad called The Tale. Danger was written before the war, looking at how the submarine could potentially alter warfare. And Arthur Conan Doyle was not too far off in terms of how devastating a weapon this could be. Predicted that pretty well. The Tale by Conrad is from 1917, and it focuses more on what warfare has become. So it's not a story with a lot of action. It's about a British vessel boarding a neutral vessel. And it focuses more on war's uncertainty, the distrust, and kind of just the morally dubious actions that are, you know, seem to be required in warfare now compared to how things used to be. So it's an interesting story. I can link to that also. And that, I think, is all we're going to say about Lusitania. There's lots of stuff that little bits we can revisit that will apply to other episodes. Also, lots of stuff about U-boats. Lots of stuff will probably be back in World War I and World War II at some point. But I think that's going to be a wrap on everything.
We are an hour and 40 minutes in, and this is the stuff we had to cut from the main episodes.
Yeah.
It's crazy that at one point we were going to make this a three-part series.
I know.
It could have been 6 or 7.
Insane.
But thanks for listening to the extra stuff. We definitely appreciate everyone who signed up for the Patreon. Yeah, that's why you're hearing this right now. Yeah, tell your friends. It's good stuff. But we always appreciate the support. And we hope you guys have enjoyed this season as we kind of transition to the next season and everything. We'll hopefully be at it and even better than we've been in the past.